Has everybody got a handout? We're not going to start off with that handout anyway, so. All right, so we're going to first finish JavaScript. There should be the second JavaScript homework that has been placed on the web. So it's meant to build a typical simpler system than this, with indexes and mainframes and three buttons. Which is sort of the primary use of JavaScript in many applications, to build these one frame that controls another frame. So the rest of the JavaScript lectures are really somewhat advanced topics or incidental topics. And this particular foil here is a foil which is illustrative of, capabilities that exist for several of the objects in a Netscape browser. So we've at length given examples of how you can access forms. So if you look at the document object, it will store, as I mentioned, essentially all information about the page, actually except the text itself. And so it will have these list of anchors, applets, image maps, that's the area, forms, images, and links. And these are stored in arrays, which when you have multiple ones of these, and so you can get a set of all the applets, images, links, etc. So in this here, we just discuss quickly, mainly just in one foil, what you can do with images. And so an image, of course, is something that's read in with a image tag. So and that typically what you specify there is the source and possibly the width. And so if you read something in an image tag and you put the name attribute to be Fred, then if you wanted to access that tag, you would say, you would reference it as document.fred. And if you wanted to know where it came from, if you can read that as document.fred.source. And so using that, you can do some dynamic things. Namely, here's an example where we define a new image. So there's an object in JavaScript called image with a capital I. So if I set, if I define a new image, and then I set the source of that image to be henry.jpg, then I can reset, I can change the displayed image in my document by setting document.fred.source equal to image1.source. So if you think about it, this allows you to do various useful things. Namely, if you were selling, here you'd have to be selling people, but more generally, selling T-shirts or a product, you can use this to define the images associated with your product. I mean, you could, when you set up your online pizza shop or whatever you want to do, you could have pictures of the pizzas, which you would open up as with these image objects, and then you would immediately generate in your JavaScript the appropriate picture corresponding to what the person ordered, because they would order the type of pizza, and then you would just set document.pizzaPicture.source equals the appropriate picture. And so this way you can use JavaScript to generate an appropriate visual image of what the person was doing. This is yet another way of also doing animated images, and there are endless ways of doing animated images on the web. There are animated GIFs, Java applets, and now here this is a JavaScript way of doing animated images, because we can now combine this with set timeout to change the source of an image every few seconds. So there are various usefulnesses of this. And this is more useful than you might think for a sort of trivial reason, namely by defining all these images ahead of time up in your header, Netscape diligently loads the image and sticks them in cache. So this means that your pictures are readily available for fast access. So this is, again, a totally different point, which suddenly it may have already caused you some problems, but it suddenly causes me some problems from time to time. And that is, it's never quite clear when Netscape or a particular JavaScript does anything. And that's partly because this is not a sequential program that starts at the beginning and works to the end. Wherever possible, it starts a new process or thread to do work that becomes necessary. Now, in Java, with the thread package, which actually Nancy didn't do in detail, it is hopefully possible to control those threads, because you assign work to the threads, so at least in principle, you can find out which thread is doing something, and make certain that it's finished when you want to use its results. Now, one problem in JavaScript, because this sort of illustrates the negative of it being such a high-level language, you don't actually see the threads underneath, which is sort of good, because that means you don't have to learn thread programming. But that means you have to rely on Netscape to finish its work. So when you start, you need to be a little careful to make certain that something is done when you want to use it. So I remember when I first started using JavaScript, I set window.location equal to something. So I naively assumed that when you set window.location equal to something, that was like a good old Fortran program, or actually a C program, and wouldn't actually return until it had done its job. However, what happens is when you set window.location equal to something, it spawns off a thread which tries to load a new document in the window, and then it executes the next JavaScript instruction. So if that next JavaScript instruction is accessing a property of this thing you were trying to load, you will find immediate error messages. So the way you have to get around that is the following. When you want to, this is why the onload, or particularly the onload event handler, is very valuable. So in this example here, supposing we wanted to set a load a page and then do something when the page is loaded. When I first programmed it, I said window.location equals page URL, then we called a function to do whatever I wanted to do, and that aborted because the stuff wasn't ready. So the correct way to do it is to do window.location equals page, and then you return. You just end your JavaScript. That's the end. Then in the page being loaded, you say onload equals what you want to be done when it is loaded. And then you do the then that event handler, which is only called when the page is loaded, then it does what you wanted to do when the page is loaded. So you can argue that requires you to change the the page that's being loaded, but that's life. That's sort of okay, because you probably only wanted to do something with that page if it had JavaScript in it anyway, because if it was a simple page with just HTML, then it would load and you probably wouldn't want to mess around with it, because there's not much you can do with pure HTML pages, because you don't really know what's in them, so you can just access them. So I don't think there's any way of finding out if a page is loaded without putting something in the on load. I mean, one strategy which they recommend is if you want to later on check, you have to set something in the on load event handler which sets a JavaScript variable. Say you initialize it to false, when it's loaded it's set to true, and you test that variable to see whether it's true or false before you do something. So anyway, I would say that this is a significant limitation of the language, and it reflects the fact that it's really not, whereas Java, at least in principle, is a complete language, in that if you programmed everything in Java, you would have control over all these features. JavaScript, you do not. All right, so now we have this thing called prototype, which I have never used, and is a feature of JavaScript 1.1, and basically it allows you to change object definitions. So here we are, we've just designed our JavaScript car, and our JavaScript car is defined by this constructor or function called car, which has actually three properties in my version here: make, color, and model. And it reads in the make and the model, and it defines all cars to be red. So that's just my particular JavaScript car. Then we have an instantiation of this car object, calling it a Ford Explorer. So then if we wanted to make this more interesting. We might want to add properties to the car object. So the way we do that is by saying car.prototype.newProperty equals whatever you want. And that adds this new property, which here is the four-wheel status, to be, defaults it to be false, because very few cars have four-wheel drive. So the prototype construct allows you to dynamically add properties to constructors. And then after you've defined it, you can use it. So here I took my car, which is the particular instance of this car object. I set it to be true because it had four-wheel drive. So we can also add methods in the same way. So here we define a new method called repaint, which sets the color of the car to be whatever the argument of the repaint function is. So then we set car, because we forgot to put repaint in the original definition, we set car.prototype.repaint equals this particular function. And then show the remarkable flexibility of this language. If we wish to repaint a particular instance in a special way, we can set mycar.repaint, which is the repaint method for the particular instance called mycar. We can set it to be any other function. Here we're called special repaint, and special repaint actually just returns so that when you repaint my Ford Explorer, it still changes. Stays red, which is what I wanted. So there are some relatively complex capabilities here which I have not used, and probably rather few people have, because this has only been put into JavaScript 1.1. Well, I don't know what I managed to do there. I didn't mean to do that. Alright, so this is more interesting. I think it's more important. This is called a cookie. And there, as far as I know, is absolutely no reason why cookies are called cookies. It may illustrate the age of Mark Andreessen, who is probably about the same age as most of you. He is the original inventor of Mosaic. Alright, so cookies, so this first foil doesn't actually describe cookies, it describes what you use if you're not going to use a cookie. So what we're trying to do is, here we are again, we're selling pizza or t-shirts or something, and we wish, and we have a server program that wishes to have a dialogue with a client. Now, if you have a server program that wishes to have a dialogue with a client, so we write our CGI script, then because we do not have a permanent connection on the, with the web, we need to be a little careful to remember which client is which, because our server program might be serving thousands of clients, because lots of people are clicking on my pizza, you know, ordering pizza or buying t-shirts, and certainly cannot assume that if it serves client one in one instance, that the next person who comes back may well not be client one, it might be client two. So it needs to be very carefully make certain that it keeps track of its users and does not get confused. So obviously it could do that by setting up a giant database with a set of a labeling scheme on the server side, but that's a little tricky and rather complicated. So it'd be a little, it would be better to do it on the client side, to make certain that your client program carries along some information to label uniquely what it is, and as it goes back and forth to the server, it carries this information with it so that the server knows who, it's he or she is dealing with. I guess, I don't know whether servers are he or she, but it is dealing with. So if you're just using traditional technology, you usually do this with a so-called hidden field. If you diligently look at the HTML form definition, you will find there is something called hidden. You can have a form entry which is inverted commas, instead of being text or button, is hidden. And so why do you have a hidden field? Well, you have a hidden field to solve this problem. Because if there's a form entry with called hidden, then that form entry is not displayed on the browser. However, it is sent back and forth to the server. So information in a hidden field is a way for the browser to send information to the server without confusing the client, or confusing the user, I should say. So how does this server make use of this? Well, the server makes use of it in the following way. You log in to order your t-shirt, and you do a few initial selections, and then it says, do you want to place, and then maybe you give your name, and then it says, do you want to place your order? So it sends you back a page with a form in it where you fill in more information. Now, unbeknownst to you, in a hidden field on that form, it has carefully preserved all the information it needs about the previous transactions between the client and that server. So secretly, every time it sends you back the form, it has additional information, which is then transmitted back automatically when you submit the form. So when you have a CGI script which has several pages where you add more information each time, I believe the conventional way of classic CGI programming of making certain that it remembers who you are and doesn't get you confused is to transmit all that information in hidden fields. Because as far as the server is concerned, when it runs a CGI script to access the information in a form, whether it's a text field or a hidden field, it looks the same to the server. It's just something with a name which has a value. Actually, the server CGI script doesn't even know it's hidden when it reads it. Well, it might be able to find out, but it certainly doesn't usually have to bother. So this using type equals hidden in an input tag is a traditional way of preserving information. So that's very valuable. So typically, when you want to log on with a password and a username, you will preserve that in hidden fields. Okay. So there is of course a clear problem here, because they really are only preserved. They're associated not just with a particular client. They're associated with a particular page of that client, because they're associated with this form, which has been diligently generated by the server. So that's rather unsatisfactory. So that means if your poor old user started buying a t-shirt, went off to a chat room to do some work, and then came back, he or she would find that all that information in the form had disappeared, because it's not associated with the browser. It's associated with a particular form and a particular page, which is not guaranteed to be preserved. So cookies are a more powerful concept than hidden. So, if you go and look at your Netscape browser on your PC or your Unix workstation, you will find various files on the client. So you'll find your executable code, etc. You will find a file holding the history, probably a directory holding the cached information, and also a file holding the bookmarks. You will also find almost certainly a file holding cookies. Because unbeknownst to you, or a lot of the sites on the web actually store information on your client, client machine in cookies. The reason they do that is they want to surprise you, so that if you're a search engine and you've found out that a particular client likes pink backgrounds, you can save that information on the client side by defining some information and ordering the client to save it. So you can automatically store information if you want to. So in general, cookies are information associated with clients, which can be generated in a variety of different ways. They can be generated from servers. They can be generated purely client-side. That requires JavaScript or Java. And then they are transmitted under certain circumstances back to the server. So this essentially allows you to build a much richer environment. Now, I would say that... So cookies are pretty... I believe, in spite of their frivolous name, likely to remain in some form or other, because they're clearly serving an important need. You must be able to associate information with the client if you want to, I think, have a reasonably rich environment. And they are fully supported, I believe, by both Microsoft and Netscape. I should also point out it's relatively clear they're not very secure, because they're sitting on a file on your machine. As far as I know, anybody can read that file. In fact, anybody can probably most people can delete that file as well. So they're hardly a very robust technology. But nor is hidden a very robust technology. I don't think it's a... So there are, I believe, some security flaws in these technologies, which presumably will have to get addressed. So if you have a cookie... So a cookie... is a piece of information. That information has five characteristics associated with it: name, expiration date, the domain for which it's valid, so that's the beginning of the URL, the path for which it's valid, that's the end of the URL, and some comment as to whether this cookie can only be used for secure servers or can be sent to unsecure servers. There are these two protocols, HTTP and HTTPS, for secure, and you can require that a cookie only be sent to a secure server. So I have an example here of a cookie. This is a little confusing example, so I made up a version of this foil set, which was cooked or has uses cookies. Right, so let's just look at it. So it lives on the cooked. It has the same directory name, except I added cooked to it. It's on. So if I now go to, I added a little button called set cookie, and I imagined actually using this cookie to do the following. To be able to set some information as to the preferred way of displaying information. And so here I've actually set it up so that the first bar, this was only a simple, I didn't try to optimize, make this terribly elegant. There are three boxes here. The first box is meant to be the width of the image. The next two boxes are meant to be various backgrounds. So I didn't actually implement the background option. So the only option that works is this. So we're allowed to set this information. And so we're going to put 10% here. We're not going to put 10%. I'll show you the code that does this. All right, so now it says show cookies. So at the moment, of the three cookies which I define, only one of them is set, and it's set to the value 10%. So if you want to see what that cookie did, you will notice that the image has got very small, because we'll see it has a little JavaScript in it to set the image size to be the value of a cookie, which cookie I ingeniously set to 10%. So why is that useful? Well, the reason why it's useful compared to some other ways of doing JavaScript is that all foils, all images in this particular foil set are set to read the same cookie. So this is an example here. We have a user preference, the width of an image, which we can set to be a cookie. I mean, you could have your favorite background file, etc. And so we can have the same foil set can now be read by different people. They can set their client computers with their user preferences, and then automatically those preferences are read and then used. And once they're read, they can be used on multiple pages because they're a property of the browser, or effectively the computer, not a property of the page. Unlike forms. If I did this with a form, that form would only give me information that was valid for this page. It would not be inherited by the next page. So I can't do. So classic JavaScript wouldn't work, because JavaScript, if I did all this in JavaScript for this page, it would wonderfully change the size of the image for this page, but the next page would overwrite all this JavaScript and it would not be preserved. We can overcome that with multiple frames, but I'm not doing it. Here I have a single frame, no frames, and so cookies are allowing me to propagate information in a convenient fashion. So let's go back to this. So if we don't like that size, we can show that this actually works. So, you know, we can make it 400%. So if we now set it to be, you see, there it is at 400% when it has been expanded rather large. So it's now four times bigger, presumably, than the actual page. So anyway, now if we go to every image, we will find they're all scaled to 400%. All right, so I hope we haven't killed this. I didn't want to do that. Let's go to set cookie. All right, so now let's see what we did there. I think I'll just, so that we don't get confused, I'll reset it to the sensible value of 100%. All right, so if I look at the, if you want to explore this, what you do is you go to the web page for JavaScript. For this page, there's this add-on button. This add-on button will automatically take you to these pages. If you look at the document source, which as usual we probably can't read very well, you will find that this program to set the cookie is classic JavaScript. So forms at the bottom with an unchanged command. That unchanged calls the process cookie function. The process cookie function, it's not very important what it does. It sets the JavaScript variable document.cookie. So the property cookie of document holds all the cookies, and it's actually a slightly peculiar variable because you set it equal to one cookie, it adds it to all cookies, and when you read it, you get all cookies. So it's a strange variable property that when set, you set a single cookie, when you read it, you get all cookies. So process cookie just sets document.cookie to be the name I decide to give to this cookie, and it sets actually the name and an expiration date. And this particular cookie I've set to actually last exactly one day. And there's a horrible syntax for specifying the date. You have to specify it in Greenwich Mean Time, which I find quite amusing. So anyway, you have to set it effectively in GMT. And so what I do is find the current time. I add one day to it, which I get by converting the time to seconds and adding 24/360 to it, so 3,600. And then I convert the whole thing to a GMT string, and I set that to be the expiration date. So if nobody changes show NPAC, this cookie will be set to this value for exactly one day, and no more. If you want to get rid of a cookie, you set its expiration date to be the current time minus 1 second. That destroys the cookie, because it's clearly expired. There are no delete cookie commands except, as far as I know, setting the expiration date to be in the past. And you'll find a function called getCookie, which I just stole out of a book on JavaScript, which scans the document.cookie value of that property and extracts a particular cookie value. This is extremely trivially stored. It's just a text. It's just a stream of text. You just got to search for the name, find the name, grab it, and then you read everything thereafter. So it's an extremely trivial format, and getCookie somebody wrote one day, and it appears to work just from my having used it in this one program. Alright, so that's, anyway, so my recommendation is you just scan this particular source. So if we go back now, of course our pages are now the right size, 100%. And if we look at the source of this document, I'll just explain how I use this cookie. So we have this standard get cookie, which grabs the value of a cookie. I happen to call this cookie wisdom image width. So I say, so the JavaScript here, which is in the header, says cooked width equals get cookie of wisdom image width, and then it checks to see if it exists. If it doesn't exist, it sets the cooked width to be 90%, which is some default value. Otherwise, it takes it. So there's some so when you have a cookie, it may or may not exist. So if it doesn't exist, you either have to invoke a form to set it, or you just set some default value. And then I use the JavaScript entities which we discussed to, where is it, yes. So I said width is equal to the value of the JavaScript variable cooked width, using the entity notation, the and sign, open curly parentheses, JavaScript variable, close curly parentheses, semicolon, which we discussed at the beginning of this. But you could use any, this is the simplest way of doing it. So we set it up here by accessing the cookie array, and then we use it here. So that's a classic use of cookies. And it's all here is purely client-side. So this example is not the server example, it's a pure client-side example. And it's effectively setting user preferences. So this is a general way of setting user preferences. We get on to this. So that's sort of meant. So we found two reasons for using cookies. Having essentially getting around the fact that the web technology does not give you permanent connections, so it effectively carries enough information to label connections. And here on the pure client side way, we were using it to set essentially a user preference. We can combine them because when your favorite web search engine or favorite web master contacts you, they can send the value of a preference cookie to your client and preload you. So you can be so you can have your cookies set for you. If you read the Netscape documents, you'll find there are various limits on the number of cookies of various sorts, but I doubt if that's gonna change. So cookies are extremely simple things. They're just a text string, essentially a single line. That line says name equals value, expires equals date, domain equals some name, path equals some name, and then the text string secure is either there or not there. And you must have a name equals value. The other parameters are the other attributes are optional. So this is just, these are strings separated by semicolons. So name is what you expect, it's a name, so that's this wisdom image width in that example I just did with the name of that cookie. Expires is the expiration date. I believe that if it's not there, it expires essentially immediately. As soon as you leave the page, it will expire. So if you wanted to last for any length of time, you should set an expiration date. And the claim is it's a modification of the GMT string. However, it appears that to use the GMT string, which is useful because it's a built-in method of the JavaScript date object, using that works. So I use GMT string. Right. All right, so the domain essentially specifies that this cookie is only valid in a certain domain. So this says, I think it's impossible to make a cookie valid for all URLs. If they're only valid for within a certain domain, and there's some rules about how complicated the domain is. Namely, I think you can have a cookie which might be valid for syr.edu. I'm not entirely clear. And certainly if it's mpac.syr.edu, it will match all mpac servers. Because all it does is starts at the end of the domain name and says, is the end of the domain name match this? And you're not allowed to say edu as your domain name it matches. That's some minimum complexity in your domain name. All right, so this allows you to customize the applicability of your cookie. The path just tells you the URL. So if you say path equals slash, that matches all paths on any server that's selected. If you don't set path equals slash, so if you don't set path, then the path is set to the path of the page that set the cookie. And so, for instance, in my example, I had to set path, because when I didn't set path, it was set to the page that set the cookie, and that actually meant it didn't work, because that path did not include the path where I want to use it, because it had some extra directory name in it. So you have to be a little careful with path. If you're not careful, it won't work. So the safest is to set path equals slash, which ensures that it works with all paths. And nothing is secure, which is useful on the web at the moment, so we'll ignore secure. All right. So that's the end of the discussion of cookies in clients. So there's this funny thing called the HTTP protocol, which you normally just have to set content equal content text that slash HTML and things like that, which is just the labeling what the type of the following document is, and also, but there is the capability of having in the HTTP protocol a set cookie line, and that set cookie line just sets the name and all the parameters of a cookie. So the HTTP protocol includes the capability of setting the values and attributes of cookies. So that's when the server sends the information to the client. When the client sends the information to the server, they just pass the name and the value. The reason they do that is they do not need to pass expiration dates, etc., because they use the expiration date, the domain, and the path to see whether they should send it. Because they're just used as an initial check to see whether this cookie is valid for this server. If they do, and you're writing your diligent CGI script, the Unix environmental variable $HTTP_cookie is set to be the values of all the cookies. And it's easy to decode. So anyway, it's rather straightforward there for the use cookies. So I've already illustrated this in the client program. Document.cookie is a property which holds all the cookies. And Netscape has diligently calculated that all the cookies are valid for this document. And it only puts in the ones that are valid for the document. And essentially, this puts in words what I've already illustrated with that example, because this is the typical use of cookies on client-side programming. All right. Well, I forgot to put an example here. So there was meant to be an example. So tainting has got at least has a nice name. And so tainting is Netscape's approach to security. Maybe it's other people's approach, but so their concept of security is to say there are certain properties which are sufficiently sensitive that once they're used in a certain way, then we can declare that this document has done something which is fundamentally insecure, and then all variables derived from that operation and all decisions made on the basis of that operation are tainted. So tainted is what the English, what you'd expect from it. It means contaminated. So in Netscape, it has the concept of contaminating code and saying that once you've done something dubious, then that code cannot be will not be allowed to do things. So the classic example of that is if you're living on, say, an MPAC server, and you go out and load information from, say, the Syracuse server, and then you say, and you load that page, and then you access the location tag, location property of that page, that is a tainted variable. And that variable is not allowed to be used or sent over the network. So it's actually very dangerous accessing location fields, because if they come from servers which are not your own, then all your code gets tainted, and it doesn't operate in the way you think it would thereafter. In particular, CGI programs start not working, because they think you're trying to take this secret information and send it over the network, and do something insecure with it. So there's meant to be the ability for various servers to say that in spite of the default, information is not tainted and can be freely used. As far as I know, nobody uses that capability. So that means once you access information from a server which isn't your own, that information is tainted. So I will add the example after this. The example is a program which does access locations and when you access, and it's running on an MPAC server, so when you access things from the MPAC domain, it's very happy. You can access the location tag and do anything you like with it. As soon as you access anything which is outside MPAC, including our InfoMail server, which we even own, then that's tainted, and this CGI script, which is processing the information, it will never send any more information to that script because it believes it's invalid. This is the most ridiculous audio system. Voice input. Somebody should kick it or something. So, the last, I think this is the essentially the last topic of importance. Yeah, there are two more topics. This is the last general topic. So this is Live Connect, and so this is really a pointer to the future. So Live Connect is very important, potentially extremely important technology, which is... It's only a Netscape technology. Anything with the word live in means it's Netscape. LiveWire with Netscape's JavaScript server. I think there's live media. There's lots of live things from Netscape. So Live Connect is Netscape's technology to link a lot of things together. So in particular, Live Connect allows Java and JavaScript inverted commas to freely interact with each other. So, in particular, you're meant to be able to freely access Java classes from JavaScript. So if you read the Netscape documentation, it will give you some examples. So here it's here's a sort of example of how you might use it. It's not terribly useful, I think, but if I had a JavaScript variable called myJavaDate, so this is a line of JavaScript I've written here. So it says myJavaDate equals new packages.java.util.date. So what does that mean? So java.util.date is just the Java utility package, and it's the construct, the date, of a Java variable, a Java object of type date. So JavaScript refers to Java packages by adding the magic object name packages in front. So packages dot then gives you access to all JavaScript Java capabilities. So if you try to use this as we have, our collaborative system Tango is based on this, you will find it still is not fully functional, and one of the confusions is typing, because Java and JavaScript have very different typing rules. Namely, JavaScript is free typing and Java is very tightly typed, and quite what type you get out of this is a little unclear. JavaScript gives, sorry, Netscape gives is this. So suppose you suppose you had a Hello World applet, and that Hello World applet, instead of writing out Hello World, wrote out the value of the Java variable, which I here I call Java's local copy. If I then write a Java method called setString, which has an argument, somewhat string, which just sets the Java variable, Java's local copy, to be the argument of setString, then I can invoke in JavaScript this this thing here, document.appletHelloWorld. So that's the way that's one of the ways I can refer to the applet Hello World from JavaScript. Then I follow that with the Java method setString, and then I can set to setString any old text string calculated by JavaScript. So this allows JavaScript to send information to Java. And in principle, you can do the opposite. You can have Java accessing JavaScript. So in principle, this is pretty powerful, because this allows you to have a whole set of applets, and then you can do some rapid prototyping, because JavaScript is essentially fully interpreted. So this allows you to have effectively a fully interpreted Java, because we can write the interpreted interface in JavaScript. So I see this as rather interesting technology, which if they get it right, could be extremely powerful. Because we can have customized Java, and then somewhat freer form, easier to change JavaScript controlling that. But I would not recommend using that. But probably, you know, 6 to 12 months from now, either this will be dead, or this will be a very important technology. If it doesn't work out, there's presumably going to be something better. All right, so. The last, if you're following the foils, you will find the last four foils go through a particular JavaScript example. Which I don't really want to go through, it's rather boring. The only, and actually this is a, all that is meant to illustrate is that you can write forms dynamically. And in the particular, it's actually a function which will either write menus or radio buttons, depending on if there are a lot of variables, it will write menus, and if there are not very many, it will write radio buttons. So it's just an example of using JavaScript in a rather complicated way to write out forms. So I don't believe we need to go through that. It's sort of technical. So. That's all I needed, or sorry, that's all I wanted to say about JavaScript. And so there is a homework. And so the next thing we're going to do is databases. Are there any questions on JavaScript? Sorry? Yeah, so Live Connect does that. All right, so I'm going to start, given the amount of time when we're meant to do databases, I'm just going to discuss I just discussed some examples of databases. So we're going to just discuss, in the next set of lectures we'll discuss various aspects of databases, and in particular their linkage to the web. And we'll start off by discussing general database technology, relational databases, but given the time, I'm going to just today give some motivation and examples of this. So as I've already mentioned, databases are extremely interesting technology because they're essentially very old database technology, and what the web has done has made this old technology much, much, much easier to use. And so I believe, whereas previously knowledge of databases was sort of a, probably only needed by a few people, I would recommend that people learn databases, because I think you'll find them an awful lot easier to use than they were in the past. And so I think you can now use databases to do some things that previously you did in much clumsier fashion, using file systems, etc., to store information, or simple flat files. And I think you'll find that the web linkage of these databases will allow you to use them in a much more satisfactory fashion. As I also probably mentioned before, databases are now much cheaper than they used to be. It used to be Oracle could charge you an arm and a leg for a database piece of software, but at least one thing we can thank Bill Gates for, because he's priced Microsoft Access at a relatively cheap price, which is Microsoft's database product, Oracle is now substantially cheaper than it used to be, unless you're running a system which Microsoft doesn't write software for, when you still have to pay a reasonable amount of money. At least for PCs, it's very cheap. All right. So this, I want to go to this example here. So this is the so-called, if you go to the MPAC homepage, you'll find this as Ask MPAC About Chemistry. So this is a typical use of databases. And so what we happen to have done is diligently store a whole bunch of email messages from in various chemistry, some, I think there's some 80 to 100 chemistry newsgroup. So it turns out that the way a lot of information is exchanged is through various newsgroups, and so, which are essentially email messages. So one of the trouble about email messages, they're not so easy to find information about them. And so what we've done is store all the messages in an Oracle database, and so we then have, then you can use these web interfaces to construct any front end you like. So here you're allowed to choose the particular mailing list, and let me try that one, chemistry ed 1, and then we decide to search, we choose how we want to search, we want to search by keyword. So we'll see if there's any information about chemistry education of VRML. And so when we press submit, what's happening is this particular client is going off to the HTTP server. That's constructing constructing this language in this language called SQL, a particular query of the database, which is asking this database for the particular things that came from the chemistry education mailing list, can you find any mail messages which have the word VRML in it? So we're just doing a text search. And so it's still, if you can't read it here, but you will find it has three such email messages, and you can then you can ask the database to give you the email messages, and then it gives you some email about from this chemist about how he'd use VRML to to build some stuff to do with chemistry, and you can then explore from there. So this is an example of sort of it's how actually both the web allows you to have a nice interface and the database. We're just using classic database functions, because databases are built to store information, and they can either be searched in free form like this or in a very structured fashion. So here we have the next example is the carrier home page. Alright, so this was built by Barbara Mihalis, who used to work in MPAC, and she spent about 6 months working on a contract with Carrier to build a database back end for their product catalog. So this is a very classic sort of corporate model. Carrier has a big fat book with all their products in, so they wanted originally just to put it on the web, and we said, well, you shouldn't just put it on the web, you might as well put it in a relational database, then you can use that to run your company, and you can also give a window to that database to customers, so that the customers can find out information about your products. And then the customers will find out as accurate as information as your internal people have, because it comes directly from the database. So so the big advantage of that over classic HTML, if you could diligently paste images about Carrier air conditioners into a web page, but then you'd have to put the model number and the pricing or the performance of that, and you'd have to fix it at the time you built the HTML page. Whereas all the information here is coming from a database is dynamically generated and presumably accurate. So it says product search, and so we could search by a product type for homes, and we then have some category. So we here's something for our office, 100 to 250 square foot, and then it's given us three models, and now we get some information about this model. So there's a picture of the air conditioner you could buy. So this is actually running in the MPAC machine room. It's running on a Sun server. There are two machines, two Suns, one running the web server, one running the database server, and this information is we're logging into the, when we go to the server, we go to the web server, that sends the request over to the database server, which constructs the HTML page and displays it here. So I would see this as, nowadays I would view this as relatively straightforward, but I think it's a rather powerful general capability. So that's the carrier example. Now let me find the other good example. All right. So the other example. So Barbara, by the way, has now left MPAC and set up her own company to pursue the construction of such databases for other companies. So it's called Four Point, her company. So here we have CareWeb. So CareWeb is built mainly by Wojtek Pomanski and some students. All right. So let's get these pages a little bigger. So I think I may have mentioned CareWeb to you. So CareWeb is Barbara based a lot of what she did on CareWeb, I would say, which itself built what it did on what Gang Cheng did. Gang was the one who built that chemistry newsgroup access, and he was the first person to build this type of system. And then his work was was effectively used by Barber and Wojtek for other types of applications. So at this stage here, let's hope the server is up. It was up 10 minutes ago. Yeah, all right. So we log in. Hopefully we're going to log in to this database. Good. Alright. So now we can... So we'll learn that databases are built around tables. Actually here we see an interface of this particular Oracle database listing all the tables. So here are all the tables we have thing, and then we'll go to the schools table. So actually this is, as I think I mentioned before, this particular example is quite interesting because this multi-frame page, so here we have 1, 2, 3, 4 frames, it's built using, so this page has JavaScript in it, but the page itself is constructed from the database. So this is an example where we're using JavaScript and the database. So we can, so this particular database is built to support school nurses. So it has schools and nurses and pupils and stuff like that. And so actually we can use the classic, the various different ways of accessing it. So if we go to the students, so we go back to the database, fetch all the students, which are sort of all rather spurious students and so on, and things like that. So, and then we can, this fellow's been pretty healthy. All his records are empty. So let's see if we can find somebody unhealthy. There's Miriam Espari, if you know her. I don't know, I can't find anybody who's ill. But, they're all in, anyway. So this is meant to illustrate that here, you see, we just have essentially classic database information. We have schools with pupils, schools with nurses, pupils with properties like name, affiliation, birth date, addresses, and they have they have associated with them visits to the school nurse, which generate various records in this database. So we have a classic relational database problem with a whole set of little tables, which are then linked, and then those are used to dynamically construct this web interface. So I would claim that's sort of so this illustrates, Wojtek constructed this in 2 to 3 months, I believe. And if you can see here, it has a very rich functionality, which we've only just begun to explore. And although Wojtek is highly talented, I think it will be impossible to build such a complex system without these powerful technologies. We may need to find the original window. Right, so let's go back. We're up to Carrier. Alright, so this page here, I may have used this one already. So this sort of describes some of the things we've actually used databases for. We saw the newsgroup application. The intranet, so that's the corporate information system, so the carrier example is an example of an intranet application. You could also believe take care web as an intranet. So an intranet is an example of an application which is not worldwide but for some focused network. So if you applied it to the network of schools and the in a school district, in this case their care web was designed for the Syracuse school district, that would be again an example of an intranet application. So we did a prototype for financial application for the school districts. We also did a database of images. The so-called Living School Book project, we've taken a bunch of CD-ROM information, stuck that in a database. This is in a classic style. If you go out in the real world, you will find the real world has a problem in many cases, because a lot of these wonderful information servers use their own proprietary database technology, and they're all facing a decision. What do? Do they switch to Windows NT? Do they switch to commercial databases? Do they switch to the web? So they're all facing transition problems, which is probably why people with the knowledge you get in this course, especially the database knowledge, find it relatively easy to get jobs, because there are a huge number of companies which have built information systems around closed proprietary systems, which you can now build totally open, actually far more powerful systems using this technology. Yes? We use ordinary databases. This is using classic ordinary databases with classic concurrency control. The web is just the interface. You're still using the Oracle database engine to get the data. So Oracle puts locks in there to ensure there's proper concurrent access control. That's the advantage of using a database. If you do it by hand, if you write a CGI script and are storing information in a file, you have to put concurrency control in by hand by writing a lock file and checking if the lock file exists, and if it does exist, wait till it's released. If you use a database, you inherit Oracle or Access or Informix or Sybase's concurrency control, which is very high quality. That's the reason you use a database. It's because people have labored for 10 years to get that exactly right. So you don't need to think about it. You do have to worry about security, because you're passing it, if the information you're passing is proprietary, but you do not need to worry about any of the database functions. So this is why I said this is an example where we're taking traditional technology and reusing it. We're not changing the database technology. We're making it much more greater use because we're linking it with a much better front end, and we're getting information into it in a much more powerful fashion, because the web can now pour information into and out of a database. The other example it mentioned here is we have a video on demand server that Marek Bogorny's group built. He's describing it in this course, CPS 600. That uses a database to store all the metadata, all the text you use for indexing, etc. It's just stored in the database. Xiaoyu, who built and others have built electronic mail systems, Gang Cheng did that originally, based where again mail goes into a database. One of the examples here is my book. So normally books have indices. When I wrote this book, I found it very hard to build an index. I didn't know how to build an table index to this book called Parallel Computing Works. In fact, that was pointed out by one of the reviewers. It wasn't a bad book, but it had a truly terrible interface index. And if this server actually returns, it will tell you the number of times where the word cosmic cube appears in this book, Parallel Computing Works, which is sitting online. But it doesn't seem to want to return. Hmm. Well, maybe the server's down. The server was up earlier today when I tried it out. Oh, here it is. All right, good. So this now tells you the that there were 12 places in this book where Cosmic Cube was found. So this is illustrative. We see again, we can now use a database technology to essentially replace indices, because these indices are now dynamically generated, etc. And so this is an example of such technology. I'll just finish this file and then we'll stop. All right, so that's the example of a digital book. So this is meant to show how you can use databases to help you, help you do searching. And of course, you can search all the MPAC information. There's a web search link on the MPAC homepage. And if you use object databases, then you can use that to build geographical information systems, which are then displayed using web technology. That again, Marek Begorny is doing that. So the number of types of applications is quite rich. That's because most projects have data, and most projects find it rather tiresome to keep track of that data, and databases are designed to keep track of data. They've never been used so much in the past just because they were rather tiresome to interface to and quite expensive. And the claim is the web is making them cheaper, and because they're making them more widely used, therefore they're going down in price, and they're substantially easier to use. So that's why I consider learning to use databases is a very important skill that I would recommend you just have. All right, so we'll stop there. Thank you.